can be maddening. You call your doctor, your cable provider, your utility company, and you get sent to hold.
There are
12
callers ahead of you.
Journalist Tom Vanderbilt, while waiting in that telephonic purgatory, wondered how we got to a place where we needed musical accompaniment. He wrote about it for the online magazine Slate and joins us now. Good to have you with us, Tom.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So, Tom, there was a time when there was actually silence if you were put on hold. How and why did that change?
Yeah, I mean, first you sort of have to think about the history of being on hold, which goes back to the creation of the telephone. When, if you think about it, in the old days when there was the old switchboard system, to merely make a call, you had to be put on hold by the operator. So that's where the phrase hold the line comes from. But then, you know, after we got out of the switchboard era and you called people and you got a direct connection, you still would call a business or something like that. And if the person wasn't there to take your call, you know, they needed some way to sort of leave you hanging there. And it was called silent hold. The problem with this is not only that it was incredibly dull, but that you were not sure if you still maintained that connection.
When did they decide to add music?
It was a bit of an accident involving a factory owner who had sort of a loose wire in the building's electrical system. And it was when they were putting people on hold, they were inadvertently picking up a signal from a neighboring radio station.
Well, does it in fact make people wait more patiently?
If you think about it, waiting on hold is the same as really waiting in any kind of queue in the real world. And if you think about, for example, the idea that putting a mirror in front of an elevator will make you distract people, give them something to do while they're waiting for the elevator, take their mind off of time, which the more we think about time, the longer it begins to dwell in our mind, the longer it seems.
What's your favorite kind of hold music?
I mean, I am a fan of Handel's Water Music, which is what got me interested in this piece in the first place. I sort of imagined Handel several centuries ago. Could he have envisioned that his music was being used for this purpose, to keep me pacified while I was waiting online? But this is sort of the thing, though. The danger with hold music is that if you play something that someone likes, you know, that's fine. If you play something that someone doesn't like, the wait will not only seem, you know, less short, it will actually seem longer. And there's even a danger that if you play something that someone is familiar with and that they even like, the wait could still be longer, because psychologists have argued that because it's a more familiar song to us, we can then shift more of our attention to thinking about things like the passage of time. So there's been some study, but a lot of it is just people are doing it, and we're the human guinea pigs on the other end of the line.
Tom Vanderbilt is a journalist and author. He wrote about hold music for Slate magazine. Thanks so much, Tom.
My pleasure.
Imagine a world 700 years into the future. Aliens are taking over the galaxy. You are on a mission to save the last city on Earth, but
if you fail, everything humans have ever known will be gone forever.
That's a clip from Destiny, one of the most hyped video games of the year, some say of the decade. It sold more than $500 million worth of copies on the first day of release. Joining us now from KQED in San Francisco is Adam Sessler. He's a gaming expert and president of Theoryhead, Inc., a media and entertainment consulting company. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So first of all, describe this game for us.
That should be an easy thing to do, but what they've attempted with Destiny is to kind of take different types of genres, the shooter genre that probably people are very familiar with from the science fiction game Halo and from the Call of Duty franchise, and another type of game that's called an MMO, that means a massively multiplayer online game, and that's when thousands of people are playing on a server in real time with one another. They brought the two together as a hybrid, so it's a shooter that you're playing with many people at the same time.
So is this something completely new?
I wouldn't say it's completely new. Most people who are playing the game are already recognizing elements from other games. It's kind of the awkward hybridization that is trying to make it sort of fresh and innovative.
I know you've been playing the game for a few days now. Has it lived up to your expectations?
To be honest, I would have to say it doesn't. And at the same time, those expectations, not just for myself, but I think for many people that follow the video game industry, were very, very high. It's quite entertaining. It's very fun to shoot aliens. But at the same time, there's not much there. you see all these elements, but it doesn't have much of a story. The inclusion of Peter Dinklage, that I think most people know from Game of Thrones, he's kind of your guide through the game, and he seems about as baffled by the dialogue he's reading as most people are when they're playing it.
Well, we have a clip from the game that includes Peter Dinklage's voice. Let's hear some of that.
Congratulations. Humans haven't been on the moon in hundreds of years.
Nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live here.
Dying here is much more likely.
So he's only one of some very high-profile people who are involved with this game. Paul McCartney helped with the score. Are big-name celebrities like that becoming increasingly involved in the creation of these games?
You are seeing sort of more celebrities move into video games. In fact, later this year, the new Call of Duty game features Kevin Spacey, and in this case, the character really looks like Kevin Spacey. The inclusion of Paul McCartney is a curious one. He helped out with the music, which is actually quite exceptional throughout the game, and he has a song that runs over the final credits, which really explicates this kind of strange unease the game seems to have with itself. I love Paul McCartney's music, but in this kind of machismo and science fiction universe, the song that plays at the end seems more appropriate for something that has a dramatic flourish where maybe the two lovers find themselves, you know, and they go on for a happy existence, not in this world that's quite dire with the end of humanity at stake.
And we will build bridges up to the sky.
Adam Sessler is a gamer and president of Theory Head Inc., a media and entertainment company. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Oh, shines brightest in the dark when nothing's ever seen. Lighting undiscovered.
John Darnielle is best known as the man behind the band The Mountain Goats. His songs are populated with high school burnouts, bitter, broken lovers, people living on the fringe who can't escape their own ghosts.
I played video games in a drunken haze. I was 17 years young. Hurt my knuckles punching the machines. The taste of scotch rich on my tongue.
His latest project is a novel, and it's centered on another social outsider, Sean Phillips. He's been horribly disfigured by an act of violence. We don't find out the details until the end of the book. He rarely goes out in public because people stare at him so much. Here's John Darnielle reading from his novel, Wolf in White Van.
They freeze up when I open the door. You can see it happen. They're in a sort of imagined forward motion, ready to launch into whatever pitch they've come to give, and then the sight of me arrests them mid-swing. Wielding this kind of power feels different from what I imagine people who crave power think they'll get if they ever get their wish. Because this can't be what people want. Or maybe it is, and I just don't really understand how power works, I think, sometimes. But then I think about it some more, and I think, yes, I do know something about what power is, how it works, what it's like. I do know.
What is it you wanted to explore through this character who has been through what Sean has been through, who's now living so isolated from most of society because of what happened to him when he was young?
I think there's a sense of which he's trying to reconcile his younger self from his present self, which I think is a pretty common story, except that he has done this damaging giant act toward the end of his adolescence that leaves this physical trace of the breach, right, of the point at which he crossed from who he was into some new thing.
Is there a part of you in that younger Sean who was so rash, who got so damaged by this terrible act?
Oh, sure, absolutely. It took me years to come around to the idea that you're always writing a little bit about yourself in any character you write, because that's the only personality you really know inside and out is your own. But, I mean, I think about when I was having this very turbulent adolescence, and several times I fled home, right? And so now I'm a parent. I can now, from where I sit, imagine the absolute horror of waking up as a parent to discover that you have no idea where your child is, right? And I was fine, and everything came out fine, and nobody's angry about it anymore. But I thought about those moments, about, you know, how on the other side of whatever age one has been, you can sort of get a feel for how your actions might have affected others.
Well, that's one of the things about this book that you explore, and you explore it through this game that you have invented and that Sean plays. First, let's talk about that game. What is the game?
It's called Trace Italian, and I think I got the idea on an airplane, because, like I say, these early drafts were all these sort of it had some really cool scenes, but I didn't know where it was going. And then I started asking myself questions about this person. Well, what does he do for a living if he is this adult who would have a hard time working a counter job or something? And I thought, well, maybe he does something through the mail.
Right. It's a game that is done strictly through the mail. I mean, it is,
right.
Which is interesting because most people think of games now as video games and that,
sure.
And that you can get lost in a video game. And yet these are people who get lost in this game that is going on by a snail mail.
It's a feat of the imagination. It's very, and this is the thing is like, you don't ever want to become a person saying, oh, well, you know, we used to have to use our imaginations back when or whatever. You want to avoid being that person. But there's something so industrious about, you know, okay, well, I will send you your move in the game and then you will imagine it and maybe plot it out in a notebook and then plot your next move and write it back to me in the form of a narrative. There's something very, I mean, almost bucolic about that. Like it seems like some other world in which you had to do more to entertain yourself, which is kind of true.
A couple of the people who are playing this game take the game eventually too far, and they leave the realm of the imagination, and they start actually doing these things, and that
right.
leads to tragedy. Why is it that a fantasy game like this can become dangerous like that?
Well, I wouldn't say that the game itself is dangerous, but it's strange for me to answer because I would never want to say, well, don't get too caught up in your dreams. You know, don't get too involved in things that aren't real, because I think that's where all the treasure lies. I get as caught up in imaginary things as I possibly can and stay there as long as I can, you know. But I think there is this, that the territory of the imagination has some real dangers, or can, if it's not walled off. And that's what they do, is they sort of take, they project the game onto the physical world, right, and start thinking that things in this imaginary space actually exist out there in the world and blur those boundaries. And in that sense, that's what it's about, is finding out that beyond a certain boundary, you can't stay in control of things.
Yeah. You know, talking about these people who become obsessed with playing the game in this book, you have some pretty intense fans yourself. Do you ever worry about your own fans obsessing with your music?
I mean, I don't worry in the sense of people taking it too far. I think I've made a point of letting people know that I don't consider, you know, my work some expression of some deep inner truth. It's a thing that I do that I hope is good and useful. But I mean, when people feel your stuff intensely, that's just a way of saying that they have actually agreed to meet you on this field that you tried to plant. That process of understanding somebody's art is a two-way street. You can't have art that just lands on somebody like a rock. You know, everybody has to meet out there in the center.
Do you figure your music fans will want to read this book, will get this book the way they get your lyrics?
Well, I mean, I think of books as very, very different from songs. I consider song like the primal state of human beings. It's the first thing you do when you are born, is you start to sing. Whereas writing is an artificial and awesome but totally different thing. It's sort of like comparing making a fire to building a house, you know. The song is fire. You react to it primally, instantly. You don't have to decide whether you like it, and you don't really have to sit down and think about it much after you're done listening to it. It really does run through you like wind. Whereas a book is a journey. It's a thing you agree to go on with somebody, and I think every reader's experience of every book is going to be different. Obviously, I hope everybody who likes my stuff enjoys the book, but I do think it's a different sort of ride. It's more of a marathon. My songs tend to sprint towards some epiphany and then explode.
John Darnielle, his new book is Wolf in White Van. He joined us from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.
The video showing the murder of British aid worker David Haynes has triggered new outrage across the world. Stills from the video are appearing on news broadcasts and websites, recharging an old debate. When is it appropriate to show such images when reporting a story? Is it ever appropriate? Kelly McBride is a media ethicist at the Poynter Institute. When we spoke earlier today, she was in transit at an airport in Cleveland. I asked her about the ethical hazards news organizations face when using images provided by terrorist groups, like the so-called Islamic State.
It's a really hard decision for news directors and news editors to make. These images and these videos are meant to be propaganda. They're meant to spread fear and terror. And when you do that, when you use these images, if you don't use them in the appropriate tone, you really are going to just play right into their hands. So I don't counsel people to never, ever use the images, but I try and tell them to pay very close attention to how they're using them, to make sure that they tell their audience how the images were obtained and what they were meant to be used for. And then I also try and tell them to add other context to the images. So, for instance, if you're showing an individual who's about to be executed, if you show other photos of that individual where he's not being held as a prisoner, it changes the tone of the coverage completely.
A lot of news organizations, including our own website, have been using photo stills from the video. Is that a problem?
You know, I think when you use them to try and tease the audience into the stories, I do think that those can be a little inflammatory. And I think, you know, even if you use a photo from the video and then another photo, if you splice it together, it has a different impact.
Clearly, groups like ISIS understand how Western media operate and want to use us to amplify their message. What's the newsroom conversation you like to hear when that dilemma comes up?
You know, what I want to hear people talking about is, can they use the photo in a way that conveys that ISIS is, yes, a terrorist organization, but how do you help the audience understand more about ISIS? ISIS spends a lot of time trying to make people afraid of them. How many people are in ISIS? How well funded are they? Where are they located? By adding all of that information, you tend to give the audience more than just, gosh, they're beheading Westerners, we should be afraid of them. And so giving more information often takes the power away from ISIS and puts it in the hands of the news organization or of the people who are trying to respond to ISIS.
In cases where there's a hostage situation, there's always a concern with news organizations that you're going to be a mouthpiece for the hostage takers. Is that something that applies in cases like this?
Yes, it definitely does. And most news organizations that have worked in an international arena have a lot of information about how to minimize the harm to hostages. And a lot of that they keep in the background. But most news organizations are paying attention to that information. And if they're not, they should be. And so if you're an editor or a producer in a news organization that hasn't been privy to those conversations, you just need to get with somebody who has.
Kelly McBride is the Vice President for Academic Programs at the Poynter Institute. Kelly, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
There's a killer disease in Africa that's even more deadly than Ebola, more prevalent than HIV or malaria. And what makes this disease so hard to fight is that so few people know they have it. Our East Africa correspondent Gregory Warner has the story.
Some blamed witchcraft, others a bad batch of moonshine. Esther Okaya, who lives in Korogocho, a slum in Nairobi, Kenya, says that even teetotalers are falling victim. One minute quarreling with a neighbor, the next minute dead. Okaya herself felt some symptoms last year. It was the same week her husband had left her, taking the money for her children's school fees. She says it was just a few mornings later that she was obliged to watch her youngest son, 9 years old, shuffling back home. He was turned away by the teacher for not paying the fee. And then that's when she felt it like her heart seized up and she couldn't breathe. At the health clinic the next day, a nurse did something to Esther that she'd actually never seen done before. She wrapped a rubber cuff around her arm that squeezed and beeped and spit out a number.
148.
148. Over 90, her blood pressure. She had hypertension, which makes her more susceptible to heart attack or stroke when activated by stress. While hypertension is a condition that we might more readily associate with a 55-year-old office worker in Memphis, it's actually more prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. It affects nearly 1 in 2 Africans over the age of 25. And while genetic proclivity to salt retention may play a role in this, another factor is economic good news. As Africans earn more and move to cities and spend more on food, their risk factors start to look more Western. Dr. Catherine Kyobutungi is the health director for the African Population Health Research Center.
People eat either too many calories, or they eat things that have too much salt in them, or they eat things that have too much fat in them. And these are really prevalent in Western societies. But then if you go within those countries, actually that prevalence is high among the poor, not the rich.
wealthier people in the West have access to better food, but also to better nutrition information. And that's the concern about Africa. Not just that so many people here have dangerously high blood pressure, but that so few are told they do. And it's not like blood pressure cuffs or some exotic new technology here. Dr. Kyobutungi was using them 20 years ago in med school in Uganda.
In Uganda, yes, of course. It was routine. It was part of the general examination. But now you'll be lucky if your blood pressure got measured in a public hospital.
Today, she says, in any given African hospital, you're more likely to find out your HIV status and get tested for malaria, because that's where foreign donors have poured in the money and the supplies and the training. So Dr. Kyobutungi came up with what seemed like a simple plan to solve this. People don't know they're hypertensive, so in 2008, she sent out health workers to screen a bunch of people, tell them their blood pressure numbers, and offer them free medication.
Free, completely free, for about 18 months.
Out of nearly 1,000 hypertensive patients she found in Korogocho slum, less than 3% accepted the free treatment. They knew they had hypertension, but they just didn't think it was important.
So you need somebody who can constantly reinforce, you know, the message that, you know, if you don't get treated, even though you don't fall sick, but actually things are happening in your body. Your kidneys are getting damaged, your eyes are getting damaged, your heart is getting damaged.
Like when you go to your doctor and you have the talk about high blood pressure, and then you go home and you hear the exact same message on some drug commercial on TV. Kenyon, she felt, needed that level of professional nagging. And she found someone to pull it off.
We talk with people one by one to tell them you are ready to get paralyzed. You're ready to get stroke.
That's what you tell them. You're ready to get paralyzed.
Yes, because the number is high.
Helen Onyango is a community health worker. She lives in Korogocho slum. And if you're over 35 years old and happen to live anywhere near Helen, she has knocked on your door, carrying a blood pressure cuff. She'll talk her way in and explain to you what a blood pressure number is.
And then you take the measurement there. You tell her, yours is 200 over 100. You are sick.
Now, a pressure reading of 200 over 100 is comfortably in the zone of a hypertensive emergency. In the United States, you'd be advised to immediately call 911. But Onyango's neighbors look at her, and then they look at her machine, and they say, me?
Hey, are you me? I'm okay. I'm not sick.
Of course, it's hard for anybody to take seriously a problem that you can't feel and that nobody's putting money into. So Catherine Kyobutungi at the Health Research Center decided that they themselves could add the economic incentive. They promised to pay community health workers an extra 100 shillings, about a dollar, for every patient they screened that actually showed up at the clinic. 50 cents if they came back a second time, which health workers, like Mary Wanjiru, thought was a really great deal, until she tried to earn it by getting these patients to the clinic.
I keep on going back to call them. They even not come that day. Maybe she shall, or he shall come the next month. So you have to wait for him to come so that you can be paid for.
And most patients, especially the men, kept them waiting forever. Helen Onyango, the first health worker we met, says she called and visited one high-risk guy for months until the day he collapsed, dead, in the road. And even then, she didn't quit.
If somebody fell down and died, I take advantage to call another one.
So if you got that, she says when one neighbor collapsed in the street with apparent stroke or heart attack, Onyango would turn tragedy into opportunity, summoning another neighbor who boasted similar blood pressure numbers to the dead guy. And she'd tell them.
You see, Jonah is dead. What about yours? Take me to the doctor.
That's pretty hardline tactics. You really
are. You see?
And this kind of persistence went way beyond the $1 incentive. This was personal. Helen would have opened up her own ribcage if it were possible to show these men the blood clot impinging her aortic artery. It's the result of her own lifelong undertreated hypertension.
When I walk, I'm feeling too tired.
What makes hypertension such a killer in Africa is that if Helen Onyango were to have a stroke or heart attack tomorrow, there's no ambulance that's going to show up in time to save her. And though she's scheduled for bypass surgery, she admits that neither she nor her adult children can hope to afford it. When the surgery day comes, she's just planning to stay home in her one-room house of corrugated tin.
till now, I didn't get someone to help me. So they told me, if not, your life is befalled.
Doctors don't give her long to live. And the same is true for millions of others. WHO scientists predict that in the next 15 years, as African populations age, the death toll from chronic diseases like diabetes and cancer, and especially hypertension, will exceed the death toll from HIV and malaria combined. But while Anyango no longer has much strength to knock on doors, she's proud that over the last 2 years, she and about a dozen community health workers, through nothing but the enduring power of badgering, increased the number of hypertensive patients under treatment in the slum from 3%, what it was in 2008, to 17% today. And that success has attracted the attention of people that have an even greater economic incentive than the community health workers. It's a group of people who, in the States, have perfected the art of schooling us in diseases we didn't know we had. Pharmaceutical executives are in talks with APHRC about scaling up the next group of Kenyans targeted for blood pressure screening from 8,000 households to 1 million. Well, that's a market. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.